Hi all. Before we get started on this podcast, I need to apologize for the sound quality. I am currently in Manila and the internet isn't that great. Plus, the AC unit is rather loud, and if I was to turn it off, then I'd probably melt while recording the podcast. Also, on last week's podcast, I remarked that the Labour Party were trying to implement a 74 KAS standard for automatic entry into New Zealand under the skilled migrant visa, and that was incorrect. That policy had been proposed by National. However, the Labour Party haven't really said anything to contest that. But yeah, I figured we would apologise for that, seeing that we're now on iTunes and actually kind of legit. So please keep subscribing. We are on iTunes. Keep subscribing on our Twitter and on the Facebook as well. The more subscribers we get, the easier it is to produce this kind of content and put a little bit more worth into it as well. So yeah, apologies for the misinformation last week and apologies for the sound quality so far. But listen to it. It's going to be great. Why? Because it's done by us and we do it for you and not necessarily the Instagram or to be on iTunes. We do it for the culture. We ain't got a dream no more, man. We got real shit. Piss out your per diem, you just gotta hate them foam. If I quit your BM, I still rock Mercedes foam. If I quit this season, I still be the greatest funk. My left stroke just went viral. Right stroke, put a baby in a spiral. Soprano C, we like to keep it on the high note. It's levels to it, you and I know. Bitch, be humble. Hold up. Sit down, be humble, sit down, be humble, bitch, sit down. Welcome to Distorted Shades of Grey. I'm Kalicho Sanwa.
And I'm Mark Stern.
And this week we are reviewing Kendrick Lamar's third full-length album, Damn. It's his first album to be top of the charts in the first week, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it's definitely been his most commercially successful album. I actually saw Drake give props on Instagram for his sales yesterday, saying yeah, you did good, which I think is interesting given their previous dynamics.
Drake is telling Kendrick, hey, good job, buddy, pat on the back. All right,
yeah, pretty much.
Interesting. But yeah, so we've wanted to speak about this album for a while, and whenever Kendrick Lamar does drop an album, it provides this entire bit of buzz and hype that comes around it, and it becomes really easy to be swept up in that hype. And there are memes all over the place of people listening to the first track for 1 minute and then posting up, this is the greatest album of all time. So it's great that we've actually taken some time to sit, let the album sit and marinate and listen to it. So we're going to break this review down in a couple pieces. One, what we actually thought of the album. We had previously spoken about how Drake and Future didn't necessarily do things for their culture, with Drake's More Life and Future and Hendrix. And so we wanted to see what the juxtaposition of it from that point of view of them doing for the culture. We also are going to speak about what we just generally thought about the album sonically, lyrically, and conceptually. And we'll also finish it off with an interesting take around Kendrick's work, and we juxtapose that with his work, with Chance the Rapper's work in Colouring Book as well. So to start with, man, we've spoken about it before, right? And it was a point that you really, really made about being disappointed about Drake and Future. Didn't necessarily put any substance towards their album. It wasn't really meaty at all. It was rather bony, I suppose. So what do you think of Kendrick's album as compared to those two?
Yeah, well, I think the thing that I struggled with More Life, which hilariously I called More Views, which, as we talked about before, I think it should be retitled, is that it was just a bit dry in the sense it felt very within Drake's wheelhouse. It didn't seem to be testing him too much. It was quite, dare I say, repetitive. There's some really great singles on there, but at the end of the day, I think the constant refrain about Drake is it might be a little bit skin deep, which is fine. It's not necessarily a bad thing. Hip hop has seemingly always had that opposition between, the native tongues doing things for the culture, Tribe Called Quest, De La Soul, Naz, you know, the people that speak truth, in inverted commas, versus those that do it for the entertainment, you know.
Mm.
For Naz, it would be up against Jay-Z. For De La Soul and Tribe Called Quest, it would have been somebody, maybe P. Diddy or somebody, I'm not sure what the exact timelines are, but, you know, there's this constant push and pull about, no, it has to be about the lyrics, it has to be about the content, it has to be about, you know, speaking truth to power in a way that lots of hip-hop doesn't have to be like that. And actually, I think one isn't better than the other. You just have your own preferences, right? And I think that conversation flows through into today with Kendrick and Drake. And I think there's definitely more similarities than you would think on the surface, right? Like, usually these kind of historic hip-hop oppositions would have been within a city, or even definitely within a country, like West Coast versus East Coast.
Yeah.
But, you know, Toronto to LA is two very different places, and Kendrick and Drake are two very different people in terms of the way that they came up and the things that they rap about. But there seems to be this unifying aspect, not just to Drake v. Kendrick, and not just to hip-hop really at all, but when you have great artists, it's kind of like, what is a man to a god? I think I read this, somebody pointing this out in a Complex article. Not that the article wasn't Complex, it was on the site Complex. I mean, it was a Complex article, it was a great article. I think it was actually from 2 years ago, when it wasn't More Life versus Damn, it was If You're Reading This Now, It's Too Late versus To Pimp a Butterfly. And I think we're 2 years down the line and we're in a very similar position. They've both released albums this year, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I don't want to take too much of a stance in terms of the content of their art. We've talked about More Life before and we'll go on to talk about Damn, but I think it comes to a conclusion that, like, I think they both need each other. I think it's kind of like the, like any great rivalry, at one half of it, you know, you need the other.
I think you're right, and I think it was really interesting what you said about the two different places that they've grown up and talked about. And, like, for all intents and purposes, Drake is pretty much middle class. So he's basically just speaking his truth and having this idea, or trying to test the layers, or test the waters of how deep and how wide his reach can be. I think that's one thing. Whereas I think Kendrick Lamar is, no, this is my story. And I think hip hop is very much has that working class feel to it. And that's where people kind of feel like this is real hip hop. And so whether it's like Eminem as a white guy, he's still speaking this working class narrative that he's kind of grown up with. And it's interesting that, because I generally think that to some extent they're both speaking their own quote unquote truths. I do think you're right about them both needing each other. It's like the Lakers without the Celtics. It's like Manchester United without Arsenal. If we didn't have Kendrick Lamar and we just had Drake, good God, what would we have? But again, at the same time, if we didn't have Drake and only had Kendrick Lamar, like, it'd feel kind of incomplete, or maybe you wouldn't necessarily appreciate the art that's going on there as well. I think Kendrick does it a whole lot more for the culture on this album as well, in terms of the ideas and views that he's trying to bring up and spring forth, and just taking a homage, one, to classic rap, to classic flow, to classic just like destroying bars and on beats. But at the same time, I think he also dives into this new age kind of form of rap where it's done on, what's the word I'm looking for? It's done on motives, and it's done on like little drop beats. So you think about the track Humble, and it's like dun 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 dun, and it's got the entire like trap kind of flow to it, and he still comes in there and murders that, as if to say, I can do it this way and I can do it the other way. In fact, I'm just doing me and I'm doing it whatever way I want. And I think that was a really like important thing that I got from it. But Kendrick also does an interview with Zane Lowe, Kiwi Hero,
The Kiwi Hero.
Kiwi
that
Hero.
No one in New Zealand seems to know that his massive radio, he's a massive radio deal in the UK and kind of in the US, and he's kind of not very well known in New Zealand.
There's this funny saying about like people being world famous in New Zealand. Well, here's a New Zealander who's world famous who's not known in New Zealand, so it's insane. But he does this interview with Zane Lowe, and he like makes a massive deal about saying, no, hip-hop is for the culture. Like, we need to do it for the culture. There's peoples whose lives are at stake and depend on it. And I think that it really much came across in this album and the message that he was trying to say as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think what you said just in the middle there about how the, especially on something like Humble, the little piano riff that it has is so kind of clean and almost minimalistic, I would say. And I would think that that is kind of supported by the minimalism seen throughout the production. Like, it's quite sparse. The trap beats are quite, you know, they're like compelling. It's a radical departure from what To Pimp a Butterfly was, with its kind of free jazz, with, you know, people like Thundercat and Brainfeeder Records and Flying Lotus doing a lot of the production and the sound, and Kamasi Washington was on there as well. You know, this is much more straightforward, and I think it's got a much smaller kind of producer credit lineup, and also in terms of featured artists, it's just essentially Kendrick out there on his own doing his thing, which I think is kind of a statement in and of itself in this time where, you know, most albums of any genre have an incredibly long list of producers and featured artists, which is great, you know, and To Pimp a Butterfly was this, it's very much, you know, or like, it's, look at something like Lemonade, it's like, look at all of these different influences and influencers that I could pull together on this one record and make it coherent and just absolutely knock it out of the park. That, you know, To Pimp a Butterfly was definitely that. It was Kendrick, you know, kind of introducing us to a bunch of artists that we had never heard of before. But now it's like, this is his thing. There's no one sharing the stage. He is like head and shoulders above the rest. And I think that comes through, and that's proven by that kind of, the credit is Kendrick Lamar and maybe some other people.
I like the fact that he does do no features, because I think, I do like songs with features. Let's get that there as well. But man, when I went and saw The Game in Manchester, he could only give me like half of his tracks. Like, because almost all of his best tracks feature somebody else in them as well. Like, he gave me like one verse from Ali Broombayer. He gave me like one verse from Hate It or Love It. He gave me like one verse from How We Do. He gave me one verse from like My Life. He gave me one verse from freaking 100. And I sat there, I was like, yo man, you need to bring the entire crew with you to do this out, to do this tour. Whereas when I saw Kendrick Lamar last year, I was just like, this is brilliant. This is absolutely brilliant, because it was all of his tracks. The only thing he couldn't do was Money Trees.
It's interesting with hip hop gets a very bad reputation as something that's like performative and live in arena settings. I don't know, where did you see Kendrick? Was it in a kind of massive conflict?
I saw him in Sydney. I think it would have had just under 45,000. So it wasn't huge, but at the same time, like,
holy,
it was okay.
Set up 45.
What, it wasn't 90,000, right? Like, it wasn't Wembley, you know what I mean?
Okay. Well, maybe, yeah, he's not quite Rihanna yet.
Yeah, but and then I saw Kanye West in Perth, and that was like 25,000. That's something else. Like, that Yeezus tour was something else.
Yeah. I think you expect it of Kanye and Kendrick. I think I've seen some of the photos of his set at Coachella, and it seems that it was very stripped back in a way that Kanye's levitating floor on top of the crowd. It's like, you know, God knows how much that cost. But yeah, I mean, getting back to Kendrick and Drake, I think they're just two very different people, right? And I agree that they're rapping about what is real to them. I don't necessarily sign on to the conversation that one is therefore more or less cultured than the other. I think what Drake has done for a city like Toronto is great, and the you have to be quite deft with what you're doing when you go to write a song about coming from the bottom and to the top when you grew up middle class in Canada. You know, there's like that's what I love about Drake. There's always this like knowing smile at himself that is kind of refreshing in a way that, like, I think if you were to sit down and have a conversation with Kendrick and sit down and have a conversation with Drake, I feel like one of those would be somewhat more relaxed, because, you know, like there's already a kind of teasing going on in Drake's music in a way that Kendrick is incredibly serious.
Yeah.
There's not, it's like, it's art with a capital A, which I love. And again, it's not a criticism. I think it's just interesting that they're different people doing different things, but both like very much on top of the popular music industry. No,
I think you're absolutely right. And I do like the idea of him just like winking at us, being like, well, I did start from the bottom of the rap industry, not necessarily life, but the rap industry. And now here I am. We'll use that to end part one. We'll be back with part two, talking about what we thought about the album. Problem is, all that sucker shit inside your DNA. Daddy probably snitched, heritage inside your DNA. Backbone don't exist, born on side a jellyfish, I gauge. See my pedigree, most definitely don't tolerate the front. Shit I've been through probably offend you, this is Paula's oldest son. I know murder, conviction, burners, boosters, burglars, ballers, dead. Redemption, scholars, fathers, dead. With kids and I wish I was fed. Forgiveness, yeah. Soldier's DNA, born inside the beast. My expertise checked out in second grade. When I was 9, on sale motel, we didn't have nowhere to stay. At 29, I've done so well, hit cartwheel in my estate. And I'm gonna shine like I'm supposed. Hi, and welcome back to Distorted Shades of Grey. This week we're discussing Kendrick Lamar's Damn, his third full-length album that he released on Good Friday, introducing us conceptually to the idea of Kendrick as God, his relationship with Christianity, how that all fits in with his identity. But before we get into that conversation, I think we just need to take apart a little bit more what is going on within the walls of Damn. I think there was rumour, actually, did you hear that he was supposedly going to release a second album on, because he released Damn on Good Friday, he was going to release an album following the same trajectory of the Easter story in the Bible. That didn't transpire, which I'm kind of, on the one hand, glad about, because you want time to digest new music, especially something as dense as Damn. Yeah. And we talked, I think, before about Future releasing two albums in the space of a week, and I just don't think it works. But man, that would have been some amazing choreography. Just the arrogance of it as well. Like, yeah. Like to come out there and have one album talking about like being terrified of God, and then be like, fuck it, I'm going to resurrect myself.
100%. What I'm saying. I mean, I think since listening to it through a few times, I'm kind of amazed at the way that the album is structured, the name of the album, and the, you know, all caps period style of the title of each track. Because, I don't know, I feel like you can't help listen to through that album and just get to the end and be like, damn. Like, that is like the only response that I can think fitting of something that is just that, like, yeah. It's really probably the least intelligent review you hear on it. But, you know, it's like, you know when somebody just crushes it and he just stood up, knocked it out of the park, and like just put a full stop at the end and being like, yeah, period, we're done here. Like, I am the best in the game. No one can step to me. It's mind-blowing to that extent that I like to think that he was just sitting there listening to it through after he recorded it all, and someone and went, damn. And they're like, yep, there we go. We got the title.
Oh man. I just noticed that he did have a full stop at the end of every single word as well.
Yeah. It's like a period. He's like made his point, and he's like, he's starting and ending the conversation every single time he steps onto a track. It's just absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Like, I think just listening to, just on beats alone, it's interesting seeing the change in track of beats that comes through. And in a certain way, it kind of feels very Kanye-ish. When you think about like the life of Pablo, where it felt half done and half completed, he would go from one beat to another beat, or like Father Stretch My Hands would have a change of beat to the next song. Whereas here, it's I can put two or three beats in a song and it flows smoothly. Like the beat change in DNA. This is my heritage, all I'm inheriting. Money and power, the maker of emeritus. Tell me something, you motherfuckers can't tell me nothing. The beat change in Fear, the beat change in Triple X. Johnny said books ain't cool no more. Johnny wanna be a rapper like his big cousin. Corporate offices, banks, employees, and bosses with homicidal thoughts. Donald Trump's in office. He does it so well, like just so seamlessly, and it's incredible that he can be that good a rapper and have that good an eye for beats as well, especially when you think about someone like freaking Nas, who's a great rapper, terrible eye for beats, or ear for beats, sorry.
Yeah, no, totally. And I think what you see is him stepping to a lot of different rappers currently in the industry in that process. Like, I think he sees Kanye and he's like, I can do Kanye better than Kanye. And he sees Big Sean and he's like, I could do Big Sean better than Big Sean. I think on one of the songs, is it like Element? I need to go back and fact check it, but one where he's like, I'll make it sexy. Going back to broke, family selling dope. That's why you many ass rap niggas better know.
If I gotta slap a pussy ass nigga, I'ma make it look sexy.
To the point where he's like, you know, he is at the same time becoming the stereotypical shtick of a commercial rapper and taking it apart at the same time, which I just think is incredibly powerful and incredibly smart to be able to do that.
Yeah, I find Element is one of like my favorite songs as well, and I don't necessarily know why, but just the play on words that he comes through, the flow, that's the other thing I want to talk about. Like, his flow is incredible, but his flow is incredible. Like the way that he can switch up the flow and have like your traditional normal type of Eric B, type of Nas, type of Andre 3000 sounding flow, and then rap as if he was Little Yachty and do a bit of job, and then rap as if he was Future and do a bit of job. I just think that this was him just boasting about his rap abilities.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I mean, it must be hard, right? Like, how do you be humble and when you're that far ahead of your peers? Like, if you are looking around and you are confident in your talent and you keep crushing it, you crush it with Butterfly, you crush it with Damn, you're going on these tours, you're selling at stadiums, you're living this like celebrity music idol life, where it must be debasing in certain ways of that kind of, yeah, what is your base, where are you coming from, what is it that like ties you back? And I think it is like amazingly arrogant, but at the same time it's posing the question of like, how do I stay humble more than I'm, you know, not humble at all, which I think is interesting, because there's an expectation there that builds of like, Kendrick Lamar always has to be Kendrick Lamar. He always has to be ahead of his game. So yeah, how do you be humble? It reminds me kind of like Serena Williams. Like, Serena Williams, the expectation of her to win at every single event that she turns up to do is like, that's a different expectation that no one else in tennis, male or female, faces currently.
The weird way between both of these people from Compton is that they put the expectations on themselves. And in Zane Lowe's interview with him, he speaks about how he's competing with himself, and he's just like, I'm the best rapper alive, and I just want to keep proving that I'm the best rapper alive. He also, and in Fear, actually alludes to like what's motivating him, and it's the thought of being judged. I guess I had some good luck at 27 years old. My biggest fear was being judged. How they look at me, reflect on myself, my family, my city. It's the thought of being seen to be losing his wealth. It's a thought of feeling that he actually isn't quite good enough, or is going to be found out and is going to end up broke back in the ghetto. And it's weird to see that that is one of the motivating factors, as well as the motivation of just like feeling like he's doing it for the culture, feeling like, because people can only get out of the hood through hip hop, where he feel what where he believes that people only get out the hood through hip hop. He feels that he needs to give his 100% utmost to it. And in another revealing bit of like information from that interview, he speaks about wanting to add like depthness and thought into his albums to make sure that they don't like fall out of people's rotations of plays after 2 weeks. He says he looks at it and he goes into every album wanting it to be like a classic that people are going to look back on in 20 years time, or that it's going to inspire the next generation or inspire someone who might change the world. Now, like, aside from the self-aggrandizing, it's quite a like a quite a daunting thing to put on your shoulders, and maybe that's why he like looks so miserable at his album.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a responsibility, a social or personal or professional responsibility to himself and others that I think, yeah, it brings a great degree of pressure. But and I think that's just what makes this album interesting, is that, like, yes, it is incredibly arrogant, like he is very much like, I am the best, but it is contextualized in so many different ways. Like, it has his relationship with God and Christianity, it has his relationship with Compton and where he grew up, it has his relationship with, you know, what happens if I am still the greatest, and what do I do while I am still the greatest. And it seems, you know, it's personal in that way. I think for every DNA, for every Humble, for every Element, which is, they have these like just amazingly powerful songs, there's like songs like Love, Feel, God, that all kind of expose a much more personal side, and a side that's kind of more dynamic, I think, than Kendrick from To Pimp a Butterfly. I know that he really struggled with the Kendrick as social activist, that he had become the voice of a generation. You know, To Pimp a Butterfly was just this incredibly like layered and introspective look at America in 2015, but that image of, okay, so Kendrick Lamar is a social activist, you know, it paints him with a brush that I think, and damn, he was very keen to shrug off, and the movement between these songs that are just like total, you know, hits in every sense of the word, with much more personal kind of sensitive points, right? Like, yeah, this personal is the word I keep coming back to. Like, on God, like, the refrain is, don't judge me. Don't judge me, my mama caught me with a strap. Don't judge me, I was young, fucking other brats. Don't judge me, aim it at your head for... Like, over and over and over again, don't judge me. And it's like, you know, it's really interesting, because you've got this person that, like, everyone will see the headlines, everyone can listen to Humble and DNA and be like, okay, yeah, this is just Kendrick doing that, you know, rapper thing where they stand up and say that they're the greatest, and, you know, some of them knock it out of the park, and some of them, they're clearly not the greatest. But actually, there's a lot more complexity on Damn than I think that assessment gives credit for.
Yeah, man, and I think you're so right that it is very, very personal. It is a very introspective look at how he feels, well, connected to God, but also how he feels connected with people. Like, you see the juxtaposition there of, like, love and lust, you know what I mean? You see the one of, like, pride and humble. A really interesting one that I remember is on the track Feel, he talks about how he feels around the world, and how he wants to help out, but he's also upset that nobody's praying for him. Feeling you all, feel like removing myself, no feelings involved. I feel for you, I've been in the field for you, it's real for you, right? Shit, I feel like ain't nobody praying for me. Ain't nobody praying for me. It actually took me aback sitting there and reading him talk about the feelings of what's going on in the world, all the things that he thinks is going wrong. And he basically says, like, I feel like I don't want to be bothered. I feel like I may be the problem. I feel like it ain't tomorrow. Fuck the world. The world is ending. I'm done pretending. And it's like, I feel for you, but who's going to feel for me? And it's crazy to sit there, and because he's basically poured out his soul into Pimper Butterfly. He's poured out and saying, I'm going to help. And he talks about it even in that album that he came up with to Pimper Butterfly to kind of help other people get through their feelings. So when someone sits there and listens to that track, it kind of helps them have a better day. And he's like, but who's trying to help me have a better day, kind of thing. And it was just this really like sad feeling of going, man, I feel for you, Kendrick. Like, I really like want to sit down with you and be like, oh man, it's not as bad as we might think it is, or shit, if it is this bad, like, how can we help you? You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. And it seems lonely and isolating in a way that is a lot more, you know, mature. He deals with it in a lot and with a much greater maturity than somebody like Kanye West, who's just like all guns blazing and then dissolves into a pool of like terrible speeches and tweets and going to see Donald Trump.
Haircuts.
And you know, you're like, I think, what was it you texted me the other day when Kanye had said something stupid, and you're like, I'm done defending these people. I'm just done. I'm through with that. I just can't anymore. You know, but anyway, so that, you know, you can clearly look at Kanye West and be like, well, there's somebody like going through a bit of a crisis at the moment, and definitely of like loneliness, isolation. I feel like his gender has a massive thing to do with that in the same way it will for Kendrick. But it feels like, you know, Kendrick putting out on the record, it's kind of a public way of working through it for himself.
Yeah. If you haven't listened to this album, I really do suggest you should like go through it and listen to it from start to finish. Stand in front of a wall, I don't know, get high, go to the ocean, do something scenic, but take your mind off everything else and sit there and listen to like the themes that he's actually trying to say here, because it is pretty heavy and it is pretty dark, but he does it in this just grand way of at the same time being really vulnerable while shouting from the rooftops, I am better than everybody in this industry.
Yeah, it's amazing.
We'll use that to end part two. In part three, we get even more deep and introspective because Kendrick wants to talk about God. You're listening to Distorted Shades of Grey with Mark Stern and me, Kalicio Sonra. Them. My resume is real enough for two millenniums. A better way to make a way, start defending them. I meditate and moderate all of my wins again. I'm hanging on the fence again, I'm always on your mind. I put my lyric and my lifeline on the line. And ain't no limit when I might shine, might grind. You rolling with it at the right time, right now. Only for the dollar sign. Bad girl, living now. Swear, leave it now. On your pulse, I can see the end.
Throughout Damn, Kendrick speaks to the anxiety good kids in mad cities feel on a daily basis. He's done it since he stepped on the scene and continues to articulate his faith in ways we haven't heard since DMX. Kanye and Chance incorporate Christianity in their music, but they don't rap about street shit with the same Old Testament fervour Kenny does. No one in rap does the juxtaposition of religion and gangsterism quite like this. He's able to tap into the vulnerability ghetto kids feel when they kick up dust in the streets and then walk into their parents' or grandparents' house as crucifixes, statues of the Virgin Mary, and portraits of a white Jesus follow their every move as if everything were.
And welcome back to Distorted Shades of Grey. I'm Kalicio Sonra, and we're with Mark Stern as well. We're talking about Kendrick Lamar's Damn album, and that excerpt that we just heard was from Complex magazine?
Yeah, Complex.com.
Complex.com. Basically, we wanted to speak about Damn, and how it actually has a whole lot of religious and spiritual ties, and the juxtaposition it has with like Chance the Rapper's. And we both loved Coloring Book, and even like Kanye West's The Life of Pablo was supposed to be seen as a gospel album, but the references towards God were just nice and flowery, and like the references from Chance's Coloring Book made you want to go to church. Like, it made me want to stop sinning and go to church and just be part of that like choir and be part of that organ. Whereas, and like the article says, Damn doesn't necessarily do that, does it?
Yeah, I think it's interesting where Kanye is playing with gospel as an aesthetic, as the great producer that he is, you know, just taking bits from sounds that he likes and layering them on top of each other and creating this almost like collage where it's very difficult to pin down a specific meaning, Chance the Rapper is, you know, gospel through and through in terms of his music is pretty much entirely about his relationship with God that is present in all places. He's very much the kind of pure, you know, gospel kid. It's difficult because he's kind of posing these questions as, well, yeah, Kanye, the gospel aesthetic is, you know, really powerful. And yes, Chance, you know, it's good to be, you know, stay close to your relationship with God and your relationship with Christianity. But how do you do that? How does that juxtapose with, you know, God that, as he raps in God about, is like very well remunerated in terms of the Christian church? How do you square that circle with America and all the craziness that is America today? And also for Kendrick, especially his celebrity, like how does he incorporate his faith and his public image? So I think it's kind of, it gives it a kind of more real embodiment of how faith works for rap stars and for kids in Compton than Chance or Kanye, I think.
Yeah, and I think what you said there in terms of like how does it square it for a different person in a different community in a different environment is really, really telling. DJ Booth wrote a think piece around this, and Kendrick Lamar actually replied to them because he felt that it was that good. But I know that when I listen to Damn It, it kind of fills me with a whole lot of questions and superstitions that make me kind of wonder why anyone would possibly want to believe in God, right? And you have a line in Fear where Kendrick basically says, why God do I have to suffer? And we spoke off air about how chilling that line can be, that it makes you not necessarily like listen to anything that happens after that because you're just left in this vortex where you're going, what is happening here? And Kendrick actually replies back to DJ Booth, who speak about how Kendrick doesn't speak about the joy and the praise, and he says that, and quote, but he sees it even more so as God of discipline, God of obedience, and God being a jealous God. And he says, I feel it is my calling to share the joy of God, but with exclamation, and more so the fear of God. So it's interesting that they both see God or the concept of God in two different ways. One looking at joy and life and the benefits, while the other's looking at, no, this is fear and this is discipline. And when you look into the actual track of Fear, where he speaks about all the possible ways he could be punished and beaten up as a 7-year-old by his parents, and then the fear of all the possible ways that he could be murdered as a 17-year-old, whether it's by the police, whether it's by the gang, whether it's by false witnesses. I probably die anonymous, I probably die with promises, I probably die walking back home from the candy house. I probably die because these colors are standing out. I probably die because I ain't know DeMarcus was snitching. I probably die at these house parties fucking with bitches. I probably die. It kind of plays into that idea of discipline, because he's just been brought up in a place of, if you do not act in the right way, you are going to be brutalized. And it's kind of weird and funny that's the relationship that he's then kind of put in there with God is, yeah, I don't want to be brutalized, so I'm going to make sure I keep discipline.
It's super interesting for me because I didn't grow up religious in any way, shape, or form. My dad's Jewish, my mom is Christian, but I never went to church. And so, you know, a lot of art that references Christian iconography, which is obviously the vast majority of Western art, I feel like often I'm kind of found just wandering around looking for the kind of the in, whereas like lots of friends that I know that grew up in very Christian households, they kind of, you know, if there's a story or a bit of music or a play that's like kind of obviously referencing a parable from the Bible, then they'll pick that up and the themes that go along with that a lot quicker than I will. So yeah, it's been really interesting for me listening to Dam and Chance and Kanye's bit go along with this as well, in terms of, you know, they're very much of their time, given that we're in post-Trump, we're in a Trump world and post-Brexit and all of these mad things in the world doesn't really make sense for me on my level. So I could kind of, if Kendrick is lonely, I guess, is he looking for God to be someone or something that will give him a companionship that he is looking for through these crazy times? Or is it more an admonishment of how can we be Christian when things are so broken? Well, maybe we'll have to call Ken.
Yeah, but I think for him, being Christian while things are broken is all he knows, right? Like growing up in that environment and society of fear, like there's, and this is a shocking indictment, but the bit about in the end of fear where he speaks about verse 2 from his uncle Carl, and I'll quote it for you. It's pretty long, but it says, verse 2 says, you only have I known of all the families of the earth, therefore I will punish you for all your iniquities. So until we come back to these commandments, we're going to feel this way. We're going to be under this curse, because he said he's going to punish us. The so-called blacks, Hispanics, and Native American Indians are the true children of Israel. We are the Israelites according to the Bible, the children of Israel. He's going to punish us for our iniquities, for our disobedience, because we choose to follow other gods that aren't his son. So the Lord thy God chastise thee. And it says here, so just like you chastise your own children, he's going to chastise you because he loves you. So it's almost this whole, things are awful because we haven't been disciplined. So to rectify that, we are going to be more disciplined to stop awful things happening to us. So if you grew up in that environment, then like something like Donald Trump being in power and the global politics of the world can seem like the most normal and natural thing, and be an even bigger push to be like, oh man, things are getting worse, let's cling on to and be more and be a better disciplined kind of feel.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because there's almost like it's almost like ludicrous that, you know, because things are bad, that means that, you know, further punishment is required, in the sense that I don't know. Like, it really sits with me, and it doesn't make sense that, because, like, is he trying to, yeah, again, admonish people for the decisions they've made, and that's why we've got here in a very kind of, like, Old Testament, we've brought this plague upon us style? Or is he trying to undermine that point? Like, because that could equally be true. He's like, how, you know, because, so if he is admonishing people for the decisions that they're making, and that's kind of how we've got here, not in terms of the powerful making decisions, but the weak making decisions, that seems at odds with To Pimp a Butterfly. So surely he's taking that and turning it around and using it knowingly, in the sense that, like, how ludicrous is it that we as people from, you know, in his case, Cobden, but in a global sense, the poor people that don't have a lot of power in kind of macroeconomic situations, how are we the ones that constantly have to take up responsibility for the way the world is when, you know, we're very far away from the likes of Donald Trump?
And this is what's interesting to me, is because, like, despite the, like, the deepness and introspective nature of To Pimp a Butterfly and Damn, To Pimp a Butterfly's, like, two biggest hits are, like, We're Gonna Be All Right and I Love Myself, right? And going back to his email to DJ Booth saying, like, it's my calling to share the joy of God, but with exclamation also share the fear of God. So this feels like it's him now showing, all right, that's the joy that we could potentially have in To Pimp a Butterfly, and now coming here in Damned and being like, well, this is the fear. this is all the fear. The fear is we've all been cursed. In Deuteronomy it says we've all been cursed, and because of the curse of being disobedient, we need to become more obedient. We need to become more disciplined, lest we have it worse for us and have to, like, look at more joy as well. But yeah, you're right. It feels really bizarre and incomplete, and I genuinely want to give him a massive hug and be like, yo, man, like, let's have a pint and a beer and talk about this and talk things through.
Yeah, it's like he's hand-wringing. He's like, I feel like what I want to come down and say is that he doesn't know the answer himself, which is kind of, you know, deep within an album that is so, you know, on the surface, you know, powerful, and not, you know, there's nothing to contest with Kendrick with. He's like laying it down, like, this is how it is, I'm the greatest, period, Damn, we're done. But actually, the more you get into it, the more you're like, he is opening up questions which there kind of isn't an answer to. You know, these are very, like, like you said, you could get yourself argued into a big deep hole, and you're like, well, maybe Kendrick, do you want to talk about it? Do you want to go out and grab a beer? Like, they're very philosophical quandaries that I don't think he should be the only one responsible in answering. But maybe he's just got himself argued into a bit of a corner on this one.
Yeah, I think that way as well, and I think like him searching for answers is very apropos, because check out these lyrics from Fear. And it's fear, what happens on earth stays on earth, and I can't take these feelings with me, so hopefully they'll disperse within 14 tracks carried out on wax, searching for resolution until someone gets back.
Isn't that just beautiful? I mean, you know, it's just so moving.
It's amazing. Yeah.
That's a mic drop right there.
All in this episode there, but highly recommend you go out there and listen to the album. And like I said, stand in front of a wall, do whatever you need to do to just be in a space where you're just going to be open to hearing everything. You won't be distracted by people telling you about how flat the earth is.
Beautiful. Thanks, guys. Thanks for listening.
And continue to do things for the culture.
Peace. I'm talking fear. Fear when this is gone. I'm talking fear. Fear that love ain't living here no more. I'm talking fear. Fear that is wickedness or weakness. Fear. Whatever it is, both is distinctive. Fear. What happens on earth stays on earth. And I can't take these feelings with me, so hopefully they disperse. Within 14 tracks, carried out over wax, searching for resolutions until somebody get back. Fear. What happens on earth stays on earth.